Welcome to Mighty Parenting, the podcast with real, raw, and relevant talk about raising teens and parenting young adults. Here are your hosts, Judy Davis and Sandy Fowler.
Welcome to Mighty Parenting, a community where we help you raise teens and parent 20-somethings so they can become happy, successful, and emotionally healthy adults. I am Judy Davis, here with my co-host, Sandy Fowler, and we love meeting great guests, learning amazing new ideas and information. We really appreciate you helping keep the shows commercial-free because it means that during the shows, we can actually focus on having our conversations that are so impactful to helping us raise our kids. So you show your gratitude for that at mightyparenting.com.
Yeah, Judy, today I have such mixed feelings about the show. I mean, I'm very excited about it, but it is. I'm going to tell people it's a tough topic. And so today, Judy and I are here with our Dassium hats on. And if you aren't aware, in addition to Mighty Parenting, we are co-founders at Dassium. It is a company that provides upstream solutions for preventing depression, addiction, and suicide in teens and young adults. We work with colleges, schools, other organizations, as well as providing products to individuals. And all of that is geared to help create awareness, to increase knowledge, and encourage action. And with September being Suicide Prevention Awareness Month, we thought that it was important to have a Mighty Parenting conversation about teen suicide so that we can all understand what is going on, why this is a growing problem, and find out what we really need to know about it.
You know, it's so easy, Sandy, and it's such a vast topic, and I want to kind of start back at the beginning, because as much as we'd like to bury our heads in the sand about this topic, the fact is that there is a teen suicide crisis happening, not only in this country, but around the world. And our teens and 20-somethings, they're hurting. And they're struggling to find hope for their future. And there's a lot of reasons for that. And one thing that I notice most of all is that they are emotionally exhausted. We've got to do something about that. And I think we can do something about that. And it starts with conversations like we're having today. One of the things that I found to be so shocking was that according to youth suicide statistics, every single day in our nation, there are an average of over 3,041 attempts by young people just in the grades 9 to 12. So suicide has become the second leading cause of death for youth between the ages of 20 and 24. And that results in 4,600 lives lost. I know that's a lot of numbers to throw at you, but losing 4,600 kids every year is tragic to me, and especially when it's something that can be prevented. But death from youth suicide is only a small portion of the problem. There's more young people survive suicide attempts than actually die. And that's such a sad statistic for me. And the reason for that is they're living in this state of hopelessness and just going through the motions, not being able to see past what's going on in this moment. I know at Dassium, we've talked about this mask that our kids wear when it comes to mental health. And it's hard to know, one, how to identify if your kid's at risk, but also to understand how to actually get them the help they need.
Yeah, Jude, I just need to go back for a second. You're right, that was a lot of numbers in there. So can we just go back to that for a minute? Mm-hmm. Tell me those statistics again on how many kids are actually completing suicide.
So on average, 3,041 attempts every single day. And the result of that is that 4,600 lives are lost in a year.
I can't even deal with that one.
Right.
And we work in this and we hear this, and that's what it is that, you know, you hear these numbers and you can't even absorb it.
Yeah.
I can't conceive of the kind of pain that our kids can be in, that they think that attempting suicide is the only thing they can do. And when you take that inability to even absorb this and pair that with the fact that many of us have little or no experience with mental behavioral health issues. So, you know, you don't want something like this to come up besides its own impact. You don't know what you would do as a parent. Like, if I see my kid or one of their friends or another kid or a niece or a nephew or someone at my church or in my neighborhood, if I see a kid who I think is having trouble, what would I even do with that? We don't know what to do with it. And so we let ourselves believe that it can't be our kid. Yeah. It can't be their friend. It can't be someone in our family. We think, oh, it can only be the kid who, you know, I mean, they always look really sad, or the kid who's always in trouble, or the one who's on drugs. Of course they end up ODing. They're on street drugs. Or, you know, the one who has some look that we think, you know, maybe they're dressing goth. Maybe to us that says that this could be a kid at risk. Maybe it's the one who smokes or has tattoos. Whatever that image is, you know, we think it can only be these kids. But the facts tell us something different. What they tell us is that suicide is not selective. It doesn't discriminate by gender, by race, by socioeconomic background. It is happening to kids from every walk of life. And Judy, you know this better than anybody here.
Yeah. And, you know, as you talk about it, I, you know, we've been working in this space for a few years now, and it's something that not only am I passionate about helping these kids, but it's affected our family in a lot of different ways. Mental health is something that is something that's happened in our family acutely, and we never knew that we would become one of these statistics. My son attempted suicide multiple times over his life, and I only found out when I got the call in 2012 from the crisis center at the university he was at. I had no idea that he was in such pain. We've told the story so much, and it's made such an impact on different families and helping them get help, that sometimes I forget the place that he was in when all this happened. And there's so many things that I could talk about and think about. But I think the most shocking when we got that call was that I had no idea that my son was in so much pain. And I think over the years, I've learned that we aren't alone. And when you said that it doesn't discriminate by gender, race, or socioeconomic background, it takes me back to a conversation that I had with someone when my son was actually in a treatment center. And they said, but Judy, he doesn't look sad.
Yeah.
And no, he didn't. No one knew the personal hell that he was in. And the reason for that is because he didn't want anyone to know. The stories in his head, the mask that he wore, was what he wanted the world to see.
Jim, I'm going to stop you for just a second, because we've made reference to this idea of the mask a couple of times. So can you tell us what you mean by that when you say the mask?
In general, when it comes to mental and behavioral health, we have this idea as a society, not just we as an individual, but as a society, of what that should, quote unquote, look like. Someone who is depressed should be unkempt, or be home sitting in bed all the time, or be unable to function like a quote unquote normal person. And the reality is that when it comes to mental and behavioral health, there is no one way of looking. And all that the person that is suffering, they don't want to put what's going on inside of their mind and their body and their experience. They don't want it to be a burden on someone else. And they don't want people to ask questions about how they feel, because they may not even know. So what happens is they put a mask over themselves, so that when the rest of the world sees them, they see what the individual wants them to. And when it came to my son, what we saw was someone who had friends, who was doing well in school, who, yes, he had a learning disability, but he was getting help to deal with that in school with a plan of action to help him be successful. He was at a university, got scholarships, you know, worked a full-time job, that kind of stuff.
He was the kid that people want their kids to be.
Yes.
The family that people look at and go, oh yeah, we want to be the Davises. They're so happy. They have such a great time. They're so fun.
Yeah. They have their shit together. Well, mm-hmm. The reality is no family has their shit together. I mean, we all have something that we're dealing with on a regular basis. Every single parent has screwed up. Every single family has skeletons. Every single person that your child deals with impacts them. And for me, the shock was I, as an involved parent, as a family that we discuss things and work together and put stuff out there and thought we were managing our kids' emotions well, there were people that impacted my son and my daughter, for that matter, in ways that we didn't know. And some of them were really debilitating and hurtful. Mm-hmm. And the kids didn't want, or, you know, especially my son, he didn't want people to know. He didn't even know that what that teacher did back in the day was wrong. He just went, I'm stupid. And his whole self-talk mindset was that of his confidence was ruined because of how he was treated. And he felt that he was the person that was wrong, not that adult. And so until we learned that he had been verbally abused by a teacher repeatedly and the impact it had that then became his filter, no one knew the pain he was going through. And that was because he didn't want us to. He truly had the thought that there was something wrong with him and that his life would never get better. And, you know, coming full circle, now I can look back and he is holding a job and, you know, yes, he still is dealing with depression. He still sees his therapist regularly. He works on his recovery program daily. And some days are better than others. But the difference is that because we share our story and we talk about it, his mask is now off. And he's being transparent that, no, it's not perfect, but he knows he doesn't have to deal with it alone. And I think that that is the stepping stone that, or the message that I want to put out there is, how do we get in front of this crisis? How do we make a difference? Because when, like you said, and you, as you were tearing up, I'm tearing up, I'm going, I'm not going to be able to do this interview because we both are so emotionally invested in wanting to bring relief to teens and young adults that sometimes it hurts if we can't. And every story that we hear of a kid that says, I can't do this anymore, we wish we could have gotten to them sooner.
Right. And in listening to what you were saying, though, you talked about, you know, the difference now for him. And one difference, too, that I think you implied, but I want to say outright is before treatment, Jeffrey thought, you know, there's something wrong with him and life will never get better. Well, now he knows that life can get better. Mm-hmm. So that was one big thing. The other big thing was you said, you know, he found out he's not alone. He doesn't have to do this by himself.
Right.
And that just reminded me, it actually didn't remind me, it made me feel so good about how many times I've heard us say in this show, all these other things we're doing, you know, we keep talking to experts and we find, more ways to parent, but we find nuances, you know, that we can apply to our parenting or new techniques or different ways of looking at things. But throughout those, what we keep hearing is that this will help our relationship with our child. And again, if you are taking the time to be here, you are a mighty parent. and you are taking the time to build that relationship. So you're already doing something to help your child. And I just want to bring that out because, you know, I don't want us sitting and blaming ourselves for anything bad that ever happens with our kids. So we are doing that. We are building that relationship. And one of our common themes here is build relationship, build communication. Communicate with them, communicate well and non-judgmentally. And I love that that runs through our shows. And I know that communication in a broader sense, Judy, is one of the things you've talked about that, you know, helps to push our kids to this place of life is just too hard. Because that's suicide. Psychology Today actually called suicide a problem-solving behavior.
Right, right.
That, I mean, that is a very interesting thought. And so I'm like, oh, problem. We can solve problems. All right, what's the problem? Well, there are a lot of things that are coming in together, but basically it's putting them in this place that you talked about. There's something wrong. There's something wrong with this young person's life and they don't see any way out. Mm-hmm. So what are what are some of the things that are going wrong with their lives? Because this is, yes, you know, people have attempted or completed suicide throughout history. But this has been growing and growing and growing and has become epidemic. And the kids who are attempting suicide are getting younger and younger. Judy, you gave us some stats for, you know, teens and young adults. They're tracking down to age 5.
Yeah.
So, but the communication piece, I'm sorry, I got off on a tangent. This broader sense of communication. I know you've talked before, Judy, about how communication skills and some of the issues that our kids have with those play into these mental health issues.
Yes, because I believe that every family and every person in our society now is over-programmed, they're overstimulated, they are so busy, and they don't know how to just be. They don't know how to be bored. They don't know how just to really and truly relax. And we're going to get into that whole lack of healthy coping strategies in a second. But
yeah, I want to go through some of this first, though.
Exactly.
This is important.
Right. And so they have this inability to actually express what's going on because they're so used to texting. So they don't get the verbal cues that someone's paying attention to them. Instead, they send a text, and if they don't get an instant response, they go, that person doesn't like me. And they get into this whole roller coaster, intertwined, you know, web of self-deprecating talk. And they make up stories of what the other person is thinking about them. This age demographic by nature is very ego-driven as opposed to understanding their place in the world. So when they don't get the response that they expect, you know, expectations versus reality, when they don't get that, then they begin to go, what's wrong with me? So they have this filter that starts, what's wrong with me? I'm not good enough. And then that message is actually reinforced by social media, by teachers, by not making the baseball team, you know, all these little things that are general life experiences that all of us have are now through a filter of, I'm not good enough. It's never going to get better. I don't see a way out of how I'm feeling. So they start looking for ways to release that pressure. So think of it like a pressure cooker, as you've got this filter that's holding all these thoughts and feelings and emotions in this little container. And the pressure just keeps building and building and building. And somehow they have to let off that steam. And so they may do it by taking a prescription meds. They may do it by getting high. They may do it by sneaking a beer. They may do it by doing an activity out that's a little dangerous and gives them
a little thrill seeking, a little sexual exploits too.
Right, exactly. anything to feel connected to something that's going to release that pressure. And so they might try a few things. And again, by nature, this age demographic is very much do A, I want a result. You know, they're very result oriented. And if they don't get that result immediately, if they don't get that immediate gratification, I mean, think about when your kid wants a new pair of jeans or they want to go out with friends, they're like a dog on a bone. They are not going to stop asking until they actually get the reward they want. And it's no different. They're not going to start trying to release that pressure with different things until they actually get the result they want and feel better. So they try something and for a split moment, they feel better. But then the next time they try that same thing, it doesn't make them feel better anymore because the pressure is just building. And then they go, see, nothing's working. And that's when they get the idea of, wow, the solution to my pain, the solution to my pressure is to end it. And that's all they can see. That's all the only solution that they see that will permanently relieve the stress and hurt and pain that they're feeling is by not being here anymore.
It can come from different areas. You know, we say emotional pain, and there are all kinds of emotional pain. You know, Jeffrey experienced verbal abuse by a teacher when he was young. Somebody else might, you know, have a total different experience. Someone else might have been through a trauma like a natural disaster. One of the other demographics where suicides have grown is the kids who are those high achievers. They're the straight A students, the ones who are in the clubs and the activities, but they're living this life that is, you said, so stress filled that they're just like, I can't be on this treadmill. I can't do this anymore. And they can't see a way out. I spoke to a group of, post-college students. They're in a vet med program. So they're on an intense roller coaster. And that was what I saw there. When it came to Q&A, they could not, even when someone, you know, even when I was standing there on the stage and they're asking me a question, I'm giving them answers about how they could solve their problem. They couldn't see it because, like you said, G, it didn't fit the expectation of what they wanted. They wanted an instantaneous, you know, pop a pill kind of a solution to this. And there isn't. There isn't that. So it's this idea of hopelessness. That's the place when we were first working in Dacia, we just kept coming back to that, that it's a hopelessness that they end up feeling.
And it's so hard to see because what causes that pressure is different for every kid.
Okay, so let's just, I mean, we're not going to hit everything and we can't cover everybody, but let's just go through a few of the other things kind of quickly that, you know, can cause the pressure. You know, you commented, you said that they don't have the good communication skills and you kind of alluded to, they don't have the ability to just be present in a moment. I know even me, I was laughing with someone just the other day, was talking about how, yeah, I was getting frustrated going, you know, it's taking forever for these websites to load. I was at someone like, you know, a family member's house and trying to do some work. So I stopped and I counted, just take a wild guess how long it was taking for websites to load.
Like 5 seconds or something.
It was taking 8 seconds and I was losing my mind. But this is a culture that we've created. Yeah. If we don't have something to do, we find something to feed us. We pull out a phone, we pull out something to feed information at us. And I just read some articles, it's neuroscience, and they're doing research and it was really interesting. It turns out that the way we access creativity in our brain, or one of the ways, is actually through boredom. When we get bored, the path of our thoughts, of our neurotransmitters in our brain, changes and shifts us over to creativity. So I'm thinking about that and going, we have this generation or even two of kids, and it's in the adults too, but we're focusing on our kids. We have all these people, and they've been raised in this society where you should never be bored, because if you're bored, you just pull something out and it will give you entertainment. It will give you information. It will force things at you instead of you lying in the grass, staring at the clouds and getting bored enough to be able to actually see shapes in the clouds.
Mm-hmm.
So, well, that mindfulness kind of a thing.
Right. And in that moment of boredom, like you said, it brings out creativity, but it also helps problem-solving skills.
Yes.
And when we don't have problem-solving skills, it's really hard to go how, you know, like you said before, suicide ideation is a problem that can be solved. And if we don't have the problem-solving skills, we can't see that there's some other solution. And that's the crux of what's going on. And I think in my opinion, I think that is the root of why we're not making a dent as quickly as we need to in this whole situation.
Because the kids can't see?
They can't problem solve to find the solutions that are different than suicide ideation.
And I think it also pairs with that relationship piece. I think relationships have changed a lot too. And I mean, it's already hard enough when kids think they should be able to solve their problems on their own. And if they don't have the problem solving skills to do it, that's an issue. In addition, I think we have a lot more kids who just feel they are alone mm-hmm. and they are lonely. And again, our society, our culture, our technology, we are much more segregated than we have ever been. You know, we used to have big old front porches or yards or whatever. And, you know, people congregated and they got together. Or if there were problems at school, you could get away from it. Now with all the tech and the phones and the social media, you can't escape that. We've talked about that with some of our experts on the show and how to help our kids with, you know, just leaving the school day behind. Mm-hmm. Judy, you talked about the expectations and, you know, when things don't happen the way they want. And we have FOMO, fear of missing out. That's a problem. Our kids are afraid they're going to miss out on stuff. They're afraid they're putting the wrong things out. You know, they're on social media. They're filtering their world through those pictures. So even if they have a problem, they may feel like they have no one to go to. They may feel like they need to work it out themselves, or they might start trying to reach out, but they can't really do it, or they put out a few maybe tentative feelers and they tend to do it through social media or something, and they'll get shot down or ignored.
Well, and you know, I think that shot down or ignored thing is something that deserves a little bit of attention, because how many times have you seen a group of teens, or let's just call it like it is actually, how many times have you seen a group of people get together because they want to do something, and then all of them are on their phones and no one's interacting in the moment?
Walk into any restaurant.
Yeah, exactly. So it's not just a kid problem.
Oh no, as I said, most of these are societal issues.
Right. And so we all have had that moment when we want to have a conversation with someone and we're excited about doing it, and they keep looking at their phone and they keep checking this and pointing out that or whatever. And you go, you know what? They really don't want to hear what I have to say anyway. I'll just go back home.
Well, it hurts and you feel alone.
And then it's just reinforcing that filter of I'm not good enough. There's no one that can help me. So,
and I want to go with that not good enough. Just one other thing. We had started out a long time ago. We keep going on tangents, but mm-hmm. another piece, and this came out in, and we'll put in the show notes which show it was from, because I can't remember right off the top of my head. My brain is in so many places right now, but we talked about the worldwide competition.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that when we were growing up, our competition was our school or our neighborhood or our dance class. And for our kids, their competition is the whole world. And so no matter how good they actually are at something, again, they're given the message, you're not good enough.
Right.
So they never get that reinforcement of being good enough. Even when, you know, mom and dad are sitting there going, oh, you're awesome, you're amazing. Oftentimes they still don't necessarily believe that because they're hearing it and they're not even hearing, they're seeing it for themselves, that there's somebody better than them, that there are a lot of people better than them because they can see everybody in the world out singing or dancing or playing their sport.
Right. And so it's almost as if the odds or the stakes are set against our kids right now. But we can change that. And that's what, you know, I want to just jump to that thing because we could be talking about this whole what's going on and everything. And I'm sitting here going, I need to know what I can do. I need to know how I can make a difference. And I think it, one, starts off with getting rid of the stigmas and myths around this topic. And I think we're doing a really great job of just kind of pointing it out, making people aware. You know, at the beginning of the show, you talked about increasing awareness, creating knowledge, and encouraging action, you know, all three of those things. And I think the awareness of understanding what's happening in our kids, why it's happening, is awesome. And now I want to go to that place of...
Judy, I'm going to interrupt you for a second, because I think before we do that, there is one other step first in the what we can do. And that is the open our eyes, be willing to accept that this is an issue, and it could be someone we know who is dealing with a mental health crisis or suicide ideation. Mm-hmm. Because we started out the show saying it's overwhelming to think about, and it's easy to stick your head in the sand. And I've been there. I've put my head in the sand. And what you find out is you're going to get bitten in the butt. Because you got your head buried, you can't see what's coming, and you're just going to get bitten in the rear end. We need to pull our heads out of the sand, open our eyes, and then, like you said, start the conversations.
Right.
Start talking about these things.
Right.
So that we can let these stigmas go away. So when someone needs help, they can get help.
Right.
And you and I have talked about, we truly, in this day and age, in this society, almost all of us need some help. To whether it's, you know, listening to this show and learning some stuff, picking up a book and learning some healthy coping strategies, working with a coach to learn some different coping strategies, seeing a therapist, taking meds. There are all different ways of getting help. And most of us need to learn new healthy coping strategies because the ones we've used in the past oftentimes can't match new pressures that we face.
Right. And it doesn't mean that everyone is at the same level of crisis. I just want to point that out.
Yes.
You know, there are a lot of different levels. It might just be someone's having a difficult situation, you know, situational depression or situational anxiety. There might be a trigger that turned making things difficult in that moment. There's a difference between that and how you will take action to get help for your child that's having a difficult moment, compared to that of a child who is truly needing immersive care. Because they're, every child, the band-aid, the fix, the action is different based on what's actually happening with your child. And I think that the only way we can identify those levels is truly, like you said, let's start talking about mental and behavioral health, just like we talk about diabetes, cancer, our fitness and our health and how we eat.
You did this level, right? You did levels. And so we're used to talking about, oh, you know, my kid needs to be able to run faster. That's a fitness level. Or, oh, you know, we have a cold, or we're trying to prevent getting a cold because it's Christmas and everyone always comes home with a cold. Or maybe they got injured, they tore a ligament, or they have diabetes, or they have cancer. All those things are things with which we need help with our health. Mental health is the same way. There are all kinds of levels, starting with, what do you do when you get your feelings hurt? When someone just makes a mean comment in a moment, or you feel left out in a moment, all the way up through suicide ideation. And there are, as you said, all these different things that people, situations that they're in, different things they need. Mm-hmm. And having these conversations is huge. This might be a first conversation for someone. Thank you for being here for this conversation. Now we're asking you to expand it.
Mm-hmm. And it's interesting because when you look, you know, social media has become this place for people to go and get support. And I think that there's some value there. And I also think that it is very, it can also be very detrimental, but we won't even go into that whole thing. But I just want to say an interesting thing that happened that I saw a few weeks ago, and it goes around this whole stigma about mental illness. There was someone on one of my feeds that reached out because they were having, they had just been diagnosed with a severe illness.
They didn't reach out to you personally. They put out on their feed.
They put out on their feed,
okay,
hey, I was just diagnosed with this. This is why I've been so absent lately. I'm dealing at the hospital, blah, 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 blah. And everyone was like, let us know if you need help with the kids. Let us know if we can bring meals over. I had a specialist that helped with that thing with my uncle. You know, everyone rallied around this person in such a way that they felt empowered. They literally put a video up saying, thank you so much. I know I'm not alone anymore. It was this rally around, we're going to get through this together kind of a thing. And you could see her outlook on facing this terminal illness change instantly. The same day, someone put up that they were going to start taking medicine for their depression and anxiety because it had gotten out of control and was really impacting their life and their ability to find joy in raising their families and running their businesses and all of that kind of thing. It was like crickets. It was, you got this, thinking of you. The response to the help was, good thing you're taking care of this. It'll be done. You'll be fine tomorrow. It was almost like push it under the rug. Let's not talk about it. There was such a stark difference in how people reacted to both of those situations. I would challenge every single listener that wants to change the conversation around depression and suicide ideation. The next time you see someone that's talking about their mental health or their behavioral health, give them the same support and insight and information and rally around them just like you would if it was some other kind of illness, because that's the second piece.
Well, that's really interesting though, because people were positive toward them, but I think we don't know what to do or what to say. Pairing that with, like you said, it's this taboo topic. So listening to you talk, I'm like, oh my gosh, it's really cool. I can just go, okay, so if this person just told me that, you know, they have to eat gluten-free, what would I tell them? Or if this person just told me that they're going to have to start taking thyroid meds and they're going to feel like garbage for a while they sort it out, what would I do? What would I say? Would I offer to start a meal train? And to kind of take that tack, I think it helps us frame it, because again, it's an unknown world for us. And when we don't know what to do, we have a tendency to do nothing. So I really like that idea of going, okay, if it was a more traditional illness, how would I respond to this? And then give the same kind of response for them. I like that.
Right. And it's about, you know, like you said, if someone said they had to start eating gluten-free and it was a family member, what would be the first thing you did, Sandy? You would go and research recipes for gluten-free.
I'd share my cookbook.
Right. Right. So you would look for recipes. You would find out latest studies or whatever like that. So mental and behavioral health, to get in front of the suicide crisis, we have to educate ourselves. And it doesn't have to be all in one big gulp. I mean, we have learned things over the years as a family. When my son was getting treatment, guess what? So did I. I worked as hard to change the behaviors that I had so that I could be a support system to him in a very healthy, pointed way. How did I know what to do? And how did I get the information to write warning signs? I did research. I dug in to how can I get information that I can then use to start conversations that move us forward instead of ignoring it.
And that is important. And so, you know, if you want to just dip your toe in the water, start getting information, you know, we said we're the co-founders of Dasium. You can go to dasium.net, dasium.net. You can go there. You can go there or on Amazon. Judy mentioned the book Warning Signs. It's a parenting guide for learning if your teen is at risk for depression, addiction, suicide. You know, you can get those there or on Amazon. But I think it's that key, Judy, is we need to start getting more comfortable with it so we can talk about it. So we have information to share. So if someone actually does open up to us, because as soon as we started doing our work in the area of depression, addiction, and suicide, people started opening up to me. And in my tiny little community, where the actual city and the three surrounding quote-unquote townships, suburbs, whatever, is like, you know, 10,000 people, I'd say, and this is people who've actually chosen to talk to me, half of the people I know are dealing with a mental health issue. But none of them had ever talked to me about it. Nor had I talked about my family's issues. I mean, you know, that's something that is again, societal. But if we can start opening it up, and if you say, well, you know, it's my child's issue, they don't want me to share, fair enough. But you don't have to go into a conversation saying, well, you know, my daughter Sandy, she had this going on and she did that. You can say, well, you know, someone close to me has had some issues and they've asked me not to share theirs personally, but this is what I've learned. Or you don't even necessarily have to say you know someone who's, you say, you know, I've been researching that and I don't know what's right for you necessarily, but this was really interesting. And by the way, I know that you guys are really busy dealing with this now. So if it's okay, I'd like to bring dinner over for you guys, drop off a dinner on Saturday. Mm-hmm. Or let's go, you know, I'd love to go to lunch, or let's go see a funny movie. You know, that those reaching out, those support things, but start with educating ourselves, move into talking about it, and as much as possible, sharing our stories. And you can certainly share your own story. You know, we all have permission to share our own stories. And if someone else is dealing with, because I have people around me who won't share any of their health issues, no matter what kind it is. And I have others who will let me spill my guts about them. So, you know, when my husband started dealing with his depression and anxiety, at first he didn't want to talk about it. Now he has his Asperger's t-shirts, he has his mental health t-shirts, and he's out there starting conversations because he's finding the same thing. When he starts telling people his story or starts a conversation, he helps someone else find relief. He helps someone else find hope.
When it comes to mental and behavioral health, that is so important. Knowing that you aren't the only one feeling that way. So as we're looking at this whole, you know, it seems like it's such a huge crisis and we can't make a difference and we can't fix it. I'm saying we can. We can start by sharing our stories. We can start by treating it just like any other illness. We can start by understanding what is really going on. And it begins in the home for yourself. And it also is that moment that you go, I might be able to help this person. And there's nothing bad about talking about mental and behavioral health. And before we wrap it up,
yes,
there's also nothing bad about asking someone if suicide is a thought that they've had. It will not put it in their mind if they hadn't thought about it, but it could be that moment that they open it up and say, yeah, I have. And then you can say, I have no idea how to get you help, but here's the thing. I will commit to you that together we'll do it.
I I absolutely agree with you, Judy. And that was one of the things that was interesting to me is that there are scientists who have actually researched to figure out if asking someone if they have thought of suicide would increase the likelihood of them attempting. And they have shown that it is not. And if you talk to somebody and, you know, they are having emotional issues on at any level and they don't know what to do about it, you can let them know. They can text, just text any word. You can text, hello, hi, it's me, help, anything they want to the number 741-741. Or you can call 800-273-TALK. 24 hours a day, those are both helplines that are available with trained professionals. Because I know some people don't want to ask about mental health issues. They don't want to ask if someone's suicidal because if they say yes, what would I do? You can sit down with them and you can call that number and say, I'm with someone who is having emotional issues, or I'm with someone who is thinking of suicide. What do we do? And they'll walk you through that.
But exactly.
That's the very intense end of it. Like we said, there's this whole gradient. Just like you eat healthy and exercise, you can learn new healthy coping strategies. You can have conversations with people. And just to go back for a second to kind of do our wrap up, the bottom line is that we are facing a crisis, that there are 4,600 kids every year who are actually losing their lives to suicide. And every day, there are over 3,000 who attempt to take their own life, that they don't see another way out, that they are feeling hopeless, or they've been caught up in one of these ridiculous challenges, the blue whale or the Momo suicide challenge. So that's why we have things like Mighty Parenting groups, so we can share that information as well as other parenting things. So suicide is not selective. It does not discriminate by race, gender, socioeconomic background, geography. None of that matters. It's about how we feel and coming to this point of hopelessness, which is pushed when we feel that there's something wrong with us or that and that things will never get better. And there are a lot of things in our culture that contribute to that. So, you know, work on helping your child understand how to use social media appropriately, how to make real friendships, how to connect with people, connect with your teen, make sure that we are doing all of those things, and then go to this place where as a community, as a culture, we are opening our eyes, we are educating ourselves, and we are talking. We are talking about our health and our happiness and everything that helps make our lives, our families' lives, better. Physically, emotionally, mentally healthy people living together. And as we said, you can go to dasium.net to get more information to start educating yourself. Mm-hmm. There's a lot there.
Right. And if you identify some other family that might need support, you know, offering an ear to listen or a shoulder to cry on, sharing your own stories, those are just some of the ways to do it. And you can also, if you don't want to have that conversation, if that's uncomfortable, give them a copy of Warning Signs. You can get it on Amazon or on dasium.net, but it's that unobtrusive approach to saying, I'm noticing some difference in your child. You might want to look at this. I learned a lot from it. And it's written from that mom and child place that helped me with all the things I wish I knew before we found my son in crisis. So that's really important. And we just want to thank you so much for tuning in today. This is such an important and emotional topic and very personal to us as parents. And we want to thank you for being part of this community. And if it is your first time listening, whew, we dove right in with you today. That's for sure.
It's not always this heavy.
No, but we want to invite you to go to mightyparenting.com, and you can see all that we have for you there, as well as connect with our social media platforms to become part of our community. And as a longtime listener, remember that you are a mighty parent, and Sandy and I will see you next week.